Hello, I'm back. Greg Kelly, the podcast. It is spring 2024. A lot's been going on. I have been consumed with family and children and radio and television. I am back in podcasting to stay. I apologize for taking a bit of a hiatus, but it had to be done. And we're going to be doing this a bit more religiously, all right? Once or twice a week, minimum, going forward, because there are some very, very important issues. And every platform that I have, I will be talking about these issues. January 6th and the lies that have been told about President Trump. And there are good people out there who are being persecuted and prosecuted for simply following the law. And one of those people is John Eastman, an illustrious law professor, a great reputation. And he gave legal advice to the President of the United States. Now, he is an academic and he's an original thinker. And you know what? In America, you're allowed to do that. You are allowed in America. And there are multiple interpretations of what, say, Article 2 of the Constitution, how it's structured, what it means. We have a Supreme Court with brilliant people who disagree all the time, 5-4 decisions. They see the same law and they interpret it the opposite way. So the idea that John Eastman can't look at, say, the Electoral Count Act and say, I think the vice president actually has this authority, and for the entire universe to say that's illegal is insane. It's totally insane. But thankfully, there are some sane people left who are brave. You know, there are a lot of sane people out there who are weak and are keeping their mouths shut. And they're keeping their heads down because, oh, I don't want to be, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to get associated with Trump. Oh, boy. Well, someone's got to do it. Someone's got to do the right thing. And January 6th, there are so many people who didn't hurt anybody, didn't break anything, were actually just exercising their constitutional rights, like John Eastman. I think he is lawfully entitled to be a lawyer. It's amazing. The guy was arrested. A constitutional lawyer was arrested in Georgia, and you know about that Fannie Willis nonsense and how that case is going down, but real people are paying a real price for the unbelievable overreach and political election interference that's being done by the left right now. Today, I speak with Harvey Silverglate, G-L-A-T-E, a total gem of a person and a lawyer. He's in his early 80s now, but he's had an amazing career that flourishes to this day. He is the lawyer representing John Eastman. He went to Princeton undergrad, Harvard Law, been active for how many years ago is that? 60 years, I guess. And he's a Brooklyn native, knew Alan Dershowitz. This is just a wonderful American success story. And in this, and by the way, guess what? He's liberal. He leans left politically. And that's fine. So what? This is a country there. You know, there used to be this kind of healthy friction, and now it's gone. But he knows what's happening is a total atrocity. And I think, well, look, I don't want to put words in his mouth. We're about to have a conversation about his client, about his life, and about the madness that is engulfing this country. I am optimistic, but quite frankly, not as optimistic as he is. He's pretty. So I think he's probably more right about that than I am, because things seem pretty dark right now. Now, I will say, you might hear a couple of audio issues. We tried to fix it. We couldn't. It was happening on his end, but he did nothing wrong. It was something with the connection, and so I apologize for that. It happens every now and then, but couldn't be helped. Nevertheless, despite the idiosyncrasies, this is totally worthwhile. Here is my conversation with Harvey Silverglate, attorney at law. You know, one moment that really bothered me in this, I don't know if you noticed it, but Vice President Mike Pence referred to the crackpot lawyers who are hanging around the president. And, you know, some of the lawyers who were there, John Eastman, Rudy Giuliani, you know, say what you will about Rudy and how he appears on TV or something like that, but that guy, he has all the credentials in the world. These are not crackpots. They have been unfairly and falsely represented as so. Would you agree?
Yeah. You want to hear an interesting story?
Please.
Do you know that I've co-authored a book with Sidney Powell?
Oh, my goodness. No, Sidney Powell. Wow. And including Sidney Powell, former federal prosecutor, right?
That's correct, federal prosecutor. Now, let me tell you in Texas, let me tell you what happened. I was married for 53 years to a fabulous woman who was a renowned portrait photographer. Her name was Elsa Dorfman, D-O-R-F-M-A-N. She died of kidney failure in 2020 because of the early photography work she did with caustic lead-based chemicals in her developing room. She died by kidney failure, which is a relatively slow way of dying. It's painless, but you go downhill over a course of about 4 or 5 years until finally you pass away. She entered the stage 6 months before she died. She entered the stage where she couldn't really do much except lie down and rest. And I took a sabbatical from my law practice in order to take care of her myself at home during the last 6 months. I had just finished half of the manuscript of a book called Conviction Machine. And I told my editor and my publisher that I couldn't finish it because I was suddenly taking care of my wife. I didn't know how long it would take. And I couldn't do it, at least for the foreseeable future. He said, well, look, let me find you a co-author to finish the book. So he looks around and hears about this lawyer called Sidney Powell. And she wrote a book about federal prosecutors and about the FBI that was very much in tune with my book. It was called Licensed to Lie. It was about federal prosecutors and FBI agents. And I have been complaining about perjury by FBI agents since the early days of my career. So I gave the go-ahead. I bought the book. You can get it on Amazon. I read it. I said to my publisher, Roger, this is perfect. She and I agree, and she's a conservative, and I'm a liberal, and it's a perfect match. She finished the manuscript. The book was published. She did the entire book tour because I couldn't do a thing. And about 3 or 4 months later, she turns up in the White House. Isn't that an interesting story?
Well, it sure is, and I think one of the nicest parts I like about it is that, you know, you found a co-author. You said she's conservative and you're liberal, and it was a perfect arrangement. And you agreed on the basic principles.
That's correct.
And that is so rare. I mean, that is just so unheard of. When you say you're a liberal, I mean, what does that mean to you?
A liberal is a person who believes economically in taking the edges off of extreme poverty, believes in free public education, believes in sort of a Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman type of liberal, or even John F. Kennedy type of liberal, as distinguished from a progressive. And there are many progressives now in Congress, progressives who are leftist ideologues who don't give a damn about civil liberties. They just want to get to a certain economic and social result. The right has the same division. There are traditional conservatives, and then there are people who start to verge into virtual fascism. They don't care how they get to the goal as long as they get to it. Liberals and conservatives are very process-oriented. That's called due process of law. So that's the definition of liberal.
So do me a favor, and then I would like to learn more about your background. What is John Eastman actually accused of doing?
He is accused of giving advice that was illegal as to how the Electoral Count in Georgia could be turned in favor of Trump. And the problem that the prosecutors have is that John Eastman's advice was completely lawful and legal. It was cutting edge. His theories, as many academics' theories are, you know, way out there. But he's an original thinker. That's how he ended up clerking for the Supreme Court. He's brilliant.
Now, how do we know what he advised? What do we know? Like, were his opinions?
Well,
or his
some of it was in writing.
Right.
There were multiple witnesses who were around when he was giving the advice. I think we're going to win the case, and he's going to testify, by the way.
He's going to testify in his own defense.
That's correct, and he makes a very good witness.
Now, what about, has he been, has his law license been suspended like Rudy Giuliani? Has he gone through any of that?
The California bar had a hearing, and they are due to make a decision either next week or the week after.
Wow. So that's coming up. Are you worried about that?
Well, of course, you understand this is right out of the Queen of Hearts, Alice in Wonderland. Here's a guy who's facing millions of dollars in legal fees because this is a RICO case, which means the trial itself will go on for 18 months. You know, racketeer, that's the state copycat of the federal racketeer influence corrupt organization, so-called RICO statute. So he's got all of these legal expenses coming up. And the California bar, before he's convicted, the California bar is thinking of suspending him. Can you imagine? It's right out of Alice in Wonderland. First the punishment and then the crime.
Well, let me ask you this, though. They disbar people for not breaking the law, right? Can you run afoul of the bar without breaking the law? I'm not suggesting your client did that, but, I mean, you can get kicked out of the bar for certain things, but that doesn't necessarily mean you broke the law, right?
Well, there are very few disbarments that don't involve breaking the law. There are disbarments. You can be disbarred for unethical practices, which doesn't break the law that you and I, that you have to follow, but which lawyers have to follow. For example, no longer because the Supreme Court threw it out. Used to be unethical for lawyers to advertise. That's not a terrible crime, but you could be disbarred for lawyer advertising until the rule got changed. So lawyers are held to a higher standards in certain areas, and they're ethical, not criminal. You could be disbarred for violating them. But if you commit a crime, that is automatically for disbarrable activity.
Sir, where did you grow up? Where were you born? And tell me a little bit about your family.
I was born and raised in the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn, New York. My father and his two brothers never completed high school, much less college, because their father got very ill with tuberculosis. Back then, before penicillin, it was a very dangerous and long-term illness. So the boys had to go to work. And my father, when I was born, he was a cab driver in Brooklyn, New York. And then he got a job at in the fur market in Manhattan. He was very skilled with his hands, and he made fur coats and repaired fur coats. When I was 11, we suddenly had to move from Brooklyn because my father reported to the federal government a crooked election in the Furriers Union, which was run at the time by Russian racketeers. And The 2 days later, two thugs showed up at our apartment in Brooklyn looking for him. My mother nearly fainted. Fortunately, my father wasn't home. And 2 weeks later, we moved from beloved Brooklyn to a suburb of New Jersey, North Bergen County, called Maywood. And because my father got a job at a furrier in Passaic, New Jersey. And I felt my life was over. I was a Brooklyn boy suddenly living in a New Jersey suburb, and I could not stand it. The only good thing that came out of that is Maywood was too small to have a high school. So I was bused to Bogota High School, which was the other side of Hackensack. Geographically, it's Maywood, Hackensack, Bogota. And it was a fairly mediocre, not terribly bad, but not terribly good high school. And the good thing that came from it was that there was a scholarship fund set up in Princeton by a family called Kane, C-A-I-N-E. And the Kane scholarship was a very large endowment that was given to Princeton, but on condition that before they could use the interest of the endowment investment for general university purposes, they had to admit and give full scholarships to three students, one from Hackensack High School, one from Hasbrook Heights High School, and one from Bogota. And because I was first in my class at Bogota, I got the Kane scholarship and went to Princeton. And from there, I went to Harvard Law School. So the move gave me a much better education than I likely would have gotten from a family that couldn't, you know, could barely support itself.
Well, okay, look, you're a brilliant guy, but you just said that the school was mediocre at Bogota. So, I mean, are you saying in a weird way that you would not have graduated number one had you gone to a more competitive school and you wouldn't have gotten
the... I have no idea. All I can tell you is that I did graduate one. That's why I got the Kane scholarship. I mean, it wasn't a terrible school, but there were students in Princeton who came from public high schools that were, you know, New Utrecht. I remember there were quite a few. There was one in St. Louis. There were some very fine public high schools, but Bogota was not one of them.
Right. What did you, how was Princeton? How did you like it?
Well, I didn't like it very much. It was a sort of a Southern boys finishing school. 53% of my classmates were from south of the Mason-Dixon line. There were no blacks in the class. It was quite racist. There were very few Jews, and I'm Jewish. Socially, it was not a great place for me, but I got an absolutely first-rate education.
And by the way, when you were there, later we'll talk about him, but you represented or worked on the case of Jeffrey McDonald, who went to Princeton as an undergrad.
That is correct.
Yeah, he's a few years younger. Did you run into him at Princeton?
No, I didn't run into him, but I think one of the reasons he asked me to represent him was because of the Princeton connection.
So did you go right from Princeton into law school?
I went right from Princeton into Harvard Law School, and I graduated 3 years later, and I started my practice.
By the way, getting into Harvard back then, I mean, today, well, 4 years ago, I'll say, it's just an unbelievably competitive school. You know, 100 people apply for every spot, maybe 1,000, maybe 5,000. I don't know what it is. Was it like that back then? And as prestigious back then as it was, as it is now?
Or? Yes, it was very hard. I had a magna cum laude average in Princeton when I applied. Now, eventually, I actually graduated with a cum laude because when my father had a heart attack, I left Princeton in April to take over his job at that time. Was he ran a candy stand in the Selwyn movie theater in Times Square. And I had to take over that job, and so I was gone. I didn't study at all for my final exams. I came back just for 2 days to take the exams, then I went back to New York to the candy stand. And I must have done very badly on the exams for which I not only didn't study, but I was, of course, very upset. I just lost my father when I was a senior in college. And I graduated cum laude, which means I probably did pretty badly on the exam to bring, in 2 days, to bring my average down from magna cum laude to cum laude. But when I applied to Harvard Law School, I had a magna cum laude average.
What did you major in?
American history.
So, and Harvard, you get through Harvard in 3 years, you started your practice. Just real quick, anything you want to say about Harvard? Was it very difficult? Was it, what was it like?
Well, because I had no money, I had a job, term time job. I worked very hard, so I never took advantage of any of the social things at Harvard. I was a workaholic. I had to support myself. But I got it was a very good education. The student body was considerably more balanced than the one at Princeton.
You said you started your own practice when you left school, law school.
What kind I worked for a law firm for 1 year. And I didn't particularly like working for anybody. The one thing, the good thing that came from that was that my late wife decided to do a magazine article about a case that I was working on. And she came in and interviewed me. And we fell in love instantly, and we were together for 53 years after that. And but I didn't like working for anybody, so after 1 year working for a firm, I started my own firm. I had a partnership with a fellow named Norman Zolkind. The name of the firm was Zolkind and Silverglate, and we're still friends. So that's sort of what happened.
And the firm that you, by the way, very quickly, what? What didn't you like about working for somebody else? What was the problem?
That senior lawyers were sort of telling me how to handle a case, and I thought I had my own ideas about how to handle a case. I was not a good person to take orders, I guess. The work was interesting, but I really wanted to be on my own so I could make my own strategy.
Right. What kind of cases did you take when you're on your own with your partner there? Like, what kind of lawyer were you? What did you specialize in? What did you do?
Well, from the beginning, I've been a criminal defense and civil liberties lawyer. The first case that I did on my own was representing 100 Harvard students who were arrested for being involved in an anti-Vietnam War riot. And there were 100 of them, and we tried them in. The judge broke the groups down to 25 each because the courtroom wasn't big enough. And then we tried the first 25, and the jury, despite clear evidence there was a riot, the jury acquitted. It shows you the amount of anti-Vietnam War feeling out there.
And by the way, throughout all of this, you're friends with Alan Dershowitz. How did you guys meet?
He arrived at Harvard Law School as the youngest tenure-track professor in the law school's history. In 1964, when I arrived as a first-year law student, we recognized each other's Brooklyn accents immediately, and so we bonded immediately. And there weren't that many people from New York in my class, much less from the borough of Brooklyn. And We were friends almost instantly, and we started to do cases together. Alan did not have trial experience. He did appeals, and our first case was one in which he was asked to represent a defendant in a Jewish Defense League bombing murder case, a very serious case in New York. He had no idea how to do it, and he asked me to work with him on it. And he wrote about that in his first book called The Best Defense. It's the first chapter. It's called The Borough Park Connection. You can get the book on Amazon. And we've been friends ever since, including in the years when he was derided for representing Donald Trump, which, of course, later on, I ended up getting a Trump-related case. So I ended up with people not talking to me. There are actually people though who walk by me on the street in Cambridge who won't talk to me. You know, it's unbelievable how narrow-minded. They've never heard of the Constitution that guarantees everybody a right to effective assistance of counsel.
So what do you think is going on there? I mean, I see these people as victims of fake news, quite frankly, and maybe that's too glib or a cheap shot, but...
No, it's not a cheap shot, but it's too narrow an explanation. I agree with you.
So what is the explanation? Go ahead.
The coverage by the press is appalling. As I said, except for the Wall Street Journal, it's appalling. It's a free country. The press can do what it wants. It's wasting its own reputation. But they can do what they want.
They can do what they want, but it's having, I mean, they're being deceptive, obviously. They're grossly biased when they pretend to be otherwise. And it's having a real impact. I mean, I see there are good people out there who have just been bombarded with the message that Donald Trump is some sort of monster who's opposed to democracy, and so are his supporters. And it's not just from the media, quite frankly. Judge Luttig, in one of the most jaw-dropping moments, and I'd like to ask you about this, actually, he said during the January 6th hearings that Donald Trump and his supporters pose a clear and present danger to American democracy.
Oh, this is nonsense.
It is nonsense, but it's worse than nonsense because I had to look it up. You know, clear and present danger, it sounds, wow, that's pretty dramatic, but what does it mean? And it goes back, I believe, to some Supreme Court case in World War I where the government can suspend certain rights if the threat to the country is of a certain level. And saying that me, as a Donald Trump supporter, that I'm a clear and present danger to American democracy, he wasn't laughed out of the hearing room. This is... go ahead.
Let me tell you something. This country has had periods before when it's gone off the deep end. It's not the first time. And eventually, our democracy is always self-corrected. There were periods. There was the Red Scare. There was the McCarthy era. During World War I, there were people who were arrested who were anti-war protesters. But we have had periods when the country has gone off the deep end, and it's always come back. And that's the difference between a democracy and a non-democracy. So I have a high degree of confidence that the current period of partisan insanity is going to self-correct eventually.
Well, here's my concern. When the government was going after communists during the Red Scare, which up until about a year ago, I thought was totally over the top. And, you know, Joe McCarthy is a terrible guy and everything that was done to those people. Turns out there were probably communists. He was really onto something. There were communists everywhere.
But let me tell you something. Being a communist is not a crime. It's protected by the First Amendment.
True. I understand
that.
Being
an anarchist is not a crime. It's only when you actually do something illegal that it becomes a crime.
I get that. But if you look at the bureaucracy now and what it stands for, there is there was more. We give McCarthy more credence now about his concerns. But let's just accept what you said. And I agree. It's not a crime to be a communist. It's also not a crime to be a Trump supporter. And let's face it, being a Trump supporter is not extreme. And they have made basic political values appear extreme. And
I think it's a betrayal of American democracy. It's certainly a betrayal of the job of the journalist.
And we talked about this, I think, briefly the other day, but can you tell me why there aren't more attorneys standing up and saying, this is wrong. The train has come off the tracks when it comes to our legal system. The lawyers who do it are so few and far between, and they pay a huge price. Listen to you. Cambridge, half of Cambridge won't talk to you. Alan Dershowitz has been kicked out of clubs. I mean, it's totally. Go ahead.
Let me tell you something. I don't give a damn if people don't talk to me. I don't give a damn if I don't belong to any clubs, so I can't be kicked out of any clubs. And, you know, Alan shouldn't worry that people on Martha's Vineyard are not talking to him. That gives him more time to do reading and stuff. You know, I just don't give a damn. And it's a free country. They can ignore me, and I can say, hey, I have no use for them anyway.
Well, look, that's fantastic. I love the attitude, and I support you. But it's actually feeling to me not such a free country anymore. I mean, this is a condition for employment. This is, you know, if you're not dancing a certain dance politically or you post the wrong thing on social media, you know, there are big corporations out there who are hostile to people who disagree with them. And
I understand, but you have to understand that 10 years from now, it'll change. The thing about this country that saves it, that unlike so many other countries in the world, it changes. It you know, this is not Russia. This is the United States. It changes all the time.
Well, the only thing that feels different about this moment is that they're persecuting ordinary citizens and the January 6th stuff. And, you know, look, January 6th, bad day, I get it. But the civil libertarians in this country should be going bananas about what's happening to these people, and they're not. And it's happened in regular people, and the fear is that if they play with the next election, you know, we're moving in a – maybe it will snap back, but maybe it won't be for 10, 20, 30, 40, 100 years.
Well, I don't think it's really 100, but I would bet it's going to be very different 10 years from now than it is today.
Well, just one more thing on this, because I want to believe that you're right, but look at how they are what they're presenting children with. I mean, why the fixation on children and gender and pronouns?
Do you understand, though, that there is a huge reaction brewing against this nonsense? Huge reaction. And it's got liberals and it's got conservatives. Huge reaction against diversity and inclusion, which makes my skin crawl. But there's a huge reaction against it. Do you know that there's a huge reaction at Harvard, which I'm part of, huge reaction at Harvard against the diversity, equity, and inclusion? The president of Harvard, who is the handmaiden of the DEI, Pauline Gay, had to resign. And saner people are now sitting in those positions at Harvard. The temporary president, the temporary provost, who I know very well, are fine, upstanding people who believe in academic freedom, who are horrified by their last couple of predecessors. And so I think Harvard in 3 years is going to be back to a liberal arts university rather than an indoctrination center for diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense.
That's all right. Well, look, I'm so gratified to hear your optimism and to hear that real progress is being made. Sometimes I don't see it, I don't feel it, but you're getting through to me, and that's fantastic. Can you do me a favor? Tell us how you first became involved in the Jeffrey McDonald case. Jeffrey McDonald, of course, for folks who don't know, was an Army physician. He was his family man, three daughters, and actually two daughters, I think. And
three.
Three? It was three?
I believe so.
I think
it's... Oh, no, you're right. It's two.
It's two. He is alleged and was convicted of killing his wife and two daughters by stabbing them in the early morning hours, I think February of 1970. I forgot the date. And
he was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
He was a suspect. The Army suspected him. They held a hearing. They found out. They determined he did not do it or there wasn't sufficient evidence. And then it took, I think, about 9 years, and he was ultimately tried at the federal level.
Yeah. And what happened was he was tried by court-martial, and he won. And then a very ambitious assistant U.S. attorney took over the case. And through a production of an enormous amount of false evidence, and really false, he got convicted and went through a series of appeals, all unsuccessful. Alan Dershowitz and I handled one of those appeals. I got into the case because Jeffrey had heard about my work, and he thought we were actually on the campus at the same time for about a year, because he's a little younger than I am. And so he asked me to represent him. I asked Alan to work with me. We did it. It was a clear case of wrongful conviction. Not only wrongful, but it was completely phony by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He concocted evidence and phony forensics. We went down to argue it in front of a guy named Franklin Dupree Jr., North Carolina. And Alan and I are sitting in court, and Judge Dupree comes out. We all stand up, sit down, and he looks down and he says, in a deep Southern accent, "So good to have you in my court, Mr. Dershowitz," intentionally mispronouncing Alan's name. And I turn to Alan, I say, "Alan, we've lost the case." And we did lose it.
So, by the way, wasn't he the trial jury?
This is
the trial judge, rather?
Yes, it was a motion for a new trial, which goes back to the trial judge. It was not an appeal.
Now, I have not heard about concocted or fabricated evidence. Do you recall what they did, how it was fabricated, what they fabricated?
Yes, they had phony forensic testimony, for example. The details of it, Errol Mars, who's a good friend of mine, has written a fabulous book in which he details all of this.
A Wilderness of Error.
It's called A Wilderness of Error, and this case was a wilderness of error. The forensic evidence was concocted. The government's the prosecution's expert witnesses were complete phonies and frauds.
And there's something else about this case that gets overlooked. It's in Errol Morris's book, but I just think it's just a fantastic moment. Just unbelievable that it happened and it wasn't followed up on. So McDonald calls 911. He calls the base MP. I think the 911 call is directed to the base MP. And he says, you know, my family has been stabbed. So the MP named Micah, M-I-C-A, Kenneth Micah,
yep,
is dispatched, and he's on his way. It's a very rainy morning. It's raining. It's about 3-something in the morning. And
yep,
they slow down at a red light just a little bit, and they see a woman in a floppy hat on the corner,
yep,
standing in the rain. And he thinks to himself, that's weird. And then he drives another half mile to the house.
Her name was Helen Stokely.
Helena Stokely. And he asks, I think Micah or somebody asked, who did this? And he said, one of the first things he said, there was a woman here with a floppy hat on. And Micah actually says out loud, "I just saw a woman like that on the corner of whatever and whatever." And nobody sent a car to look for her. And
that's correct.
And that was not even followed up on. They wanted to bury that piece of information in
yep,
the Article 31, right?
Yep.
It's incredible.
It's the worst injustice I've had in a 50-something year career. The worst injustice.
Did you meet him, by the way, in person, McDonald?
Sure.
What was your impression of him?
Well, I believed him. My impression is he's very intelligent, well-spoken. If surely he did go to Princeton. And I didn't like all my classmates, but there was nobody dumb there. And I believed him. And everything he said panned out. The government's expert forensic witnesses were charlatans. What can I say?
And by the way, Helena Stokely, who probably was that woman in the hat, went around confessing to just about everybody in town that she was there.
That is correct. But for some reason, the government they were wedded to the idea that the husband did it. You know, it was almost like this is like a true crime story for them. It might have made all their careers, of course.
Do you think the whole episode of McDonald puts the case against Trump, the cases against Trump, in a new light? Like, the government can just get it in its head that something happened and just go out to prove it no matter what. Evidence be damned.
Right.
We're going to get this guy.
It's the age-old problem of coming to a conclusion and then working to prove the conclusion.
Do you think if Trump should get back into office, that Jeffrey McDonald, well, forget about Trump for a second. I mean, the guy. Do you think the guy should be pardoned, his sentence commuted? What should happen to him if there was to be true justice done? What should happen?
Oh, if there was true justice done, he would be pardoned. Not just commuting the sentence, he'd be pardoned. It's an outrageous case.
And do you think, by the way, it's interesting that certain cases these days get a lot of attention and certain cases don't. Granted, the McDonald case over the years has gotten plenty of attention. But the public...
Well, it's such a spectacular case.
But it's faded...
The idea that a father was convicted of murdering his two daughters and his wife, and that's a spectacular... I just stated it.
But the, I guess my question is this, have you noticed it, I've noticed it, that the idea of the exonerated defendant, you know, wrongfully convicted, the media love that story. And who doesn't love a story about those wrongfully convicted and a justice, injustice being righted? But I noticed that it seems pretty much focused on identity politics, people of color. I see that as driving at least the media coverage, and it might even be driving the judicial approach. You know, the lawyers who are more likely to take those cases. Am I totally off the wall here? I feel like there's a racial component to this stuff.
Well, I think that it is true that a lot of black people get worse trials than a lot of white people. And that's a result of economics. They don't have as good lawyers. Plus, you know, in some states, there's some jury bias, still some racial jury bias. So, you know, there's some ground for that. But by and large, the system treats whites quite badly, even if maybe not quite as badly as it treats blacks. It's not a good system the way it is working now for anybody.
And you've written about this. I guess the system doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. But if you could reform it, and reform is a pretty loaded, broad word, but what could and should be done to make our judicial system better?
Well, I think a lot of it starts at the law schools. I think that if we could, and I'm running again this year for the fourth time. I'm trying to get on the Harvard Board of Overseers. One of the things I'd like to do is turn Harvard back to quality education and get rid of all of these diversity, equity, inclusion courses. Develop real standards. Do you know now that over 90% of students at Harvard get A's? Well, that's absurd. It can't be. So standards have to be reinstated, and there should be real courses. You know, the things like these ethnic studies courses are utter nonsense. People basically are simply taught their own presuppositions and biases. I think we just have to move back to real education, and the way to do it is for alumni to rise up, as I'm doing, running for the Harvard Board of Overseers, and say, look, we've had it. I think that movement is actually taking root all over the country, that there are people who are protesting.
Mr. Silverglade, again, thank you. What a guy, huh? And his amazing wife. Yeah, no kidding. Looking here at her pictures, Bob Dylan, she took care of pictures of everybody famous over the decades. She is, may she rest in peace. Well, Mr. Silverglade, thank you again. And thank you for listening. Podcasts will be updated weekly, at least for now. And then we're thinking about going twice a week. So, to be continued, many thanks. This has been the Greg Kelly Podcast.